Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's president says that the U.S. needs to remove the obstacles to an agreement on revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. Asian stock markets slide following the broadly negative cues from Wall Street overnight as the Federal Reserve delivers another big interest rate hike to cool galloping inflation. And Russia and Ukraine carry out the largest prisoner swap since the war began, involving almost 300 people, including 10 foreigners fighting for Kiev. Our top story for this half hour: the Iranian president says obstacles which are impeding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal should be removed by those who have created them. Speaking to a number of U.S. foreign policy experts in New York, Ebrahim Raisi said Iran has not withdrawn from the agreement and has lived up to its commitments under the accord. Rather, he stressed it was Washington that unilaterally pulled out of the deal, and it's the Europeans that are reneging on their obligations. He said Tehran approves of talks with the aim of reaching a just and logical outcome. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is accompanying President Raisi in his New York trip, told his Irish counterpart Simon Coveney that Tehran is ready for a good and lasting agreement during talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA. He also urged the U.S. as well as Britain, France, and Germany to be realistic and show the will to lift sanctions on Iran. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi calls for the prosecution of former U.S. President Donald Trump for ordering the assassination of top general Qasem Soleimani.
The fair pursuit of justice in the face of the crime the former American president admitted to is serving the humanity. We will seek through a fair tribunal to bring to justice those who ordered and those who committed the martyrdom of our beloved general Qasem Soleimani.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Raisi underlined that the Islamic Republic will legally pursue the U.S. assassination of the anti-terror icon. He also hailed Iran's role for confronting high-handed and interventionist policies, including the, quote, U.S.-crafted terrorism. Elsewhere in his speech, Raisi strongly condemned the West for applying double standards when it comes to human rights issue. He said those supporting rights violations and terrorism must be held to account. The Iranian president also stressed the need for multilateralism, saying it has far-reaching significance for a just world. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg from Toronto says raising the issue of General Qasem Soleimani's assassination at the UN General Assembly was a positive step.
Well, I think it's an excellent move on President Raisi's part. This was outrageous, and it was ignored by the world. It was just disappeared, assassination of a senior official. So I don't know if the UN can do much, but it's worthwhile just to keep the world aware of who the real terrorists are in the world. Biden spoke out against terrorism and to support Ukraine. But his version of terrorism is completely the reverse of the real terrorism going on, which is predominantly by the U.S. itself. So it's good that at least Iran is not afraid to stand up at the U.N. and call things as they are. So that is a very, very positive sign out of the UN General Assembly.
Well, journalist and author Daniel Azar says the U.S. has gone to great lengths to protect its global hegemonic status.
the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991 essentially left the U.S. as the sole remaining superpower, and the U.S. has done its best to make the most of that of its status by imposing its rules on all other countries, or doing its best to, and tolerating absolutely no dissent. So, you know, so a country like Iran finds itself, you know, under attack by America, under ceaseless attack. I mean, its scientists are killed, its top generals are assassinated, it's subject to a brutal economic blockade. And it just goes to show how fundamentally intolerant the American hegemon really is. And other countries which run afoul of America, Nicaragua, for example, Venezuela, or certainly Russia, receive the same treatment. And this kind of unilateral assertion of American power can only lead to confrontation and war. There simply is no way out of a military showdown.
Asian markets extend a painful Wall Street sell-off following a further hike in Federal Reserve interest rates. Shares fell in China, Japan, and South Korea on Thursday. Markets in Singapore, Indonesia, and the Philippines were also in the red. That's after all three benchmarks in Wall Street finished more than 1.7% down, with the U.S. Federal Reserve raising interest rates by 0.75% for the third consecutive time this year. The new hike brings the central bank's benchmark interest rate to its highest level since 2008. Fed boss Jerome Powell said the central bank will stay the course with its aggressive measures to bring the 40-year high inflation down. He admitted that such policies would affect the American economy, but said there is no easier way to tackle rising prices. And the European Union is planning to impose new sanctions against Russia over Moscow's military operations in Ukraine.
Additional restrictive measures against Russia will be brought forward immediately, as soon as possible, in coordination with our partners. In line with the United Nations Charter and Internet.
The EU High Representative added Europe will continue to support Ukraine and provide it with military equipment as long as needed. He also condemned plans for referenda in parts of Ukraine to join Russia. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against his country. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II, which would likely add 300,000 reservists to support its military operations in Ukraine. Well, Russia and Ukraine have carried out their largest prisoner swap since the war began in February, involving almost 300 people. Under the terms of the deal, 215 Ukrainians were released in addition to 10 foreigners who fought for Kiev. Among those released were five commanders who led a prolonged Ukrainian defense of Mariupol earlier this year. In exchange, Ukraine sent back 55 Russians and pro-Moscow Ukrainians. The leader of a banned pro-Russian party who was facing treason charges was also sent to Russia. Ukraine said that Turkey and Saudi Arabia helped with the prisoner swap. Kiev says a swap was under preparation for quite a long time and involved intense haggling. And Italy's elections are a few days away. Opinion polls show the leader of far-right Brothers of Italy party is a leading candidate to replace outgoing Prime Minister Mario Draghi. Max Gigli reports from Rome.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the Five Star Movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same.
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the U.S. government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the U.S. move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the U.S. certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Moving on, chaos prevails throughout England's Midland cities as a bitter dispute between Muslim and Hindu communities escalates. Clashes and scuffles were reported in Leicester over the weekend, while another standoff occurred outside a Hindu temple in Birmingham on Tuesday. A correspondent, Robert Carter, was in Birmingham to find out what's causing the wave of hostilities between the two communities.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
They think they can do the same thing here what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades and never had any issues with them whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along and they've caused so much grief here. And most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
A young girl has been fatally shot during a live fire drill by the US military near the Iraqi capital Baghdad, a 15-year-old, Zainab Issam Al-Ghazali. Was hit by a bullet originated from the Victoria military base near Baghdad International Airport. An Iraqi security source says a probe has been launched into the murder, which is being described as a random shooting. Asaib Ahl al-Haq, a political group, has called the U.S. military action a flagrant breach of Iraqi sovereignty. The U.S. invaded the Arab country in 2003 to oust then-Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but Washington continues to maintain its troops there under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Iraqis have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the U.S. military presence in the country, calling for them to leave. Palestinian schools in occupied Al-Quds went on a strike Monday over an Israeli plan to impose textbooks. This is a serious matter since Israel is trying to distort the facts in its favor, but this futile attempt will not yield the results as Palestinians are much smarter, but the move adds to the friction that already exists between Palestinians and Israelis, making their coexistence much harder.
It wasn't just any school strike in the occupied Palestinian territories. It was a general strike due to attempts by Israel to censor and edit Palestinian textbooks in Al-Quds. The goal of the regime, to introduce an Israeli curriculum in classrooms. Neither the students nor the teachers were having it. In all, most of the 280 Palestinian schools in East Al-Quds, with some 115,000 students from kindergarten to grade 12, were observing the strike. The head of the Parents' Committee Union said if Israel's efforts succeeded, it will have control over the education of 90% of students in Al-Quds. What was Israel doing exactly? Well, on the one hand, Israel granted private schools licenses. They give them then funding, but in exchange they impose a distorted version of Palestine and its history. And when it comes to municipality-run schools, they were forced to teach the altered version. Israel was in essence trying to Israelize or Judaize the books taught at school. Palestinians have long held the view that Israel is imposing its political and historical will, trying to alter the facts on the ground.
Our books don't incite the children. They teach them, and this is our basic right, and no country in the world can forbid us to learn our history. No one can forget his own history, and this is why our curriculum includes it. Our curriculum is Palestinian and nationalistic. There is no way that it will include anything different than the Palestinian point of view.
What are we supposed to put in our curriculum? Should we write poems praising the Israelis? Should we write about Israeli history? I mean, should we adopt the occupation's viewpoint? We are Palestinians. We protect our cause, our feelings, our sovereignty, our dignity. So it's logical that we have some nationalistic material. It's nothing like incitement. It's just what we rely on.
If this is bad, what is covered in Israel-run schools and textbooks is worse, but not unexpected. The bias in textbooks there depicts Palestinians as terrorists, refugees, and primitive farmers. And if that isn't alarming, it states that the killing of Palestinians is depicted as something that was necessary for the survival of the Jewish state, that this killing is something good. Yet Israel believes the Palestinian books are the ones distorting reality and presenting Israel in a negative light. That has been the belief for quite some time from the Israeli side.
When you see that the other side of the conflict teaches its children from kindergarten to university that the Jewish nation has no right to exist, and certainly not here in the Middle East.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Sacred Defense Week. September 22nd, the day in which the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran started in 1980, has been designated as the start of the Sacred Defense Week in the Islamic Republic of Iran. A week which ends on 28th of September, please stay with us for a special program on the occasion of the Sacred Defense Week, from 22nd to 28th of September. On 22nd of September 1980, the Ba'athist regime of Iraq, headed by the dictator Saddam Hussein, started a fully-fledged war against the nascent and newly formed Islamic Republic of Iran. The Islamic Republic was just over a year old at the time, and the dictator Saddam declared war on Iran by appearing live on Iraqi national television and tearing up a copy of the 1975 Algiers Accord, a key peace agreement between Tehran and Baghdad. Thus, the eight-year Ba'athist military aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran had started. Let us first of all take a look at the history of the 1975 Algiers Accord. On 6th of March 1975, Tehran and Baghdad took a crucial step to end several years of border disputes and border skirmishes, which had marred relations between the two countries. Even though the accord itself and all of its addenda and associated memoranda of understandings were signed in Baghdad, the accord came to be known as the Algiers Accord, since the president of Algeria at the time, Houari Boumediene, and other senior officials of Algeria had acted as mediators and conciliators. However, the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein tore up the agreement and attacked Iran on 22nd of September 1980, initiating a costly eight-year war. The war was imposed on Iran under circumstances where the arrogant powers, particularly the United States, had placed Tehran under a lot of pressure, and Iran's armed forces were still in disarray, still recovering from the unavoidable turmoil of the revolution. Using Saddam and his army as their tool, the arrogant powers were hoping to wipe out the Islamic Republic. But the brave Iranian nation, with its absolute faith in Islam and unflinching determination, proved them wrong, scuppering all of their calculations and all of their plans, and leaving behind some formidable achievements, such as its unique culture of jihad and self-sacrifice and staunch resistance. Thus, as the Islamic Revolution triumphed under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, so it was that under his leadership, Islamic Iran triumphed in the eight-year imposed war. For the first time in the past 200 years, Iran had successfully resisted an invasion, driven back the invaders, had not lost even an inch of territory, and had achieved all of this without any help from the outside world. The late Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, had remarked, "We unveiled the true face of the colonialists and the arrogant powers during the imposed war. We recognize who were our friends and who were our enemies. During the war, We came to the conclusion that it was essential to stand on our own feet and not rely on others. And we shattered the image and the prestige of the two superpowers from the East and the West. The truth is, the 8 years of Sacred Defense brought with it some very valuable and lasting legacies for both Islamic Iran and the wider Islamic world. These legacies include growing self-confidence and self-belief, unwavering belief and faith in religion, the flourishing of Iran's talents and creativity, strengthening of national unity, more social cohesion, the growing authority and power of the Islamic Republic, Iran's cherished independence, becoming a role model for other nations to follow, and helping to awaken the Islamic world. The Islamic Republic of Iran has also been extremely successful in manufacturing a formidable range of military hardware, weapon systems, and ballistic missiles, giving the country considerable deterrence capabilities. Some of these ballistic missiles include the Shahab, the Fateh, the Qiyam, the Ahmad, the Sajil, the Khurramshahr, the Sful, Fateh Mubin, and Rad 500 ballistic missile. The military website 1945, in a well-known analysis, has concluded that the Islamic Republic of Iran has the most extensive, most effective, modern, and capable ballistic missile arsenal in the West Asia region, giving Iran a formidable deterrence capability and power. Commenting on the formation of a wide front consisting of both the East and the West against the Islamic Republic of Iran during the 8 years of imposed war, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "The main intent of this wide-ranging front was to create internal problems for the Islamic Republic of Iran, to weaken this country, and ultimately to destroy this country. But the great Iranian nation, despite all the difficulties and shortages at the time, successfully resisted this wide-ranging front and emerged with its head held high and with flying colours."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has spoken at the 77th UN General Assembly in New York. His speech was directed at the promotion of peace and justice. In the same breath, he slammed countries that promoted this notion, yet in action did the opposite, like the U.S. and its warmongering policies. In this edition of the program, we will look at some of the points that Iran's president has made and why Iran spoke from a position of strength compared to the U.S. when it comes to making a world a better place and a more peaceful place to live in. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. Also joining us is Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. Obviously, there's many things that Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said during his address at the UNGA, which was his first time there, making the statements in the speech that he made. Let's talk about how he said that Iran was not seeking an atomic weapon. He made sure that something that was known before, that it got highlighted again, and that it was a fatwa coming from Imam Khamenei, and demanded U.S. guarantees that it would abide by any JCPOA sanctions removal deal. Why do you think he repeated that and deemed that to be important to highlight in his speech?
Because the Islamic Republic of Iran has some principles, and unlike the kind of immoral politics that we're used to across the globe, we tend to find that politics is a dirty word, fundamentally, because nobody says what they mean. And the Americans, of course, have demonstrated that within the JCPOA. The Europeans have demonstrated their ill will in that regard during the negotiations with Iran also. But the Islamic Republic of Iran has stuck very solidly to what it said, even though nobody else was abiding by the JCPOA. And the Americans walked out without even a flinch. Unilaterally. Nonetheless, Iran tried its best for at least a year, if not more, to comply with what was an agreement which effectively had already been made redundant. And since then, it's been a huge amount of patience shown on the part of the Iranian negotiators, the Iranian establishment, to try and keep this JCPOA scenario alive. In reality, you could very strongly argue that the Islamic Republic of Iran doesn't need the JCPOA. They've done quite well, thank you very much, through resistance economy, through a greater direction towards the east, the rise of the Eurasian axis, the increasing kind of look away from the west. Particularly with this establishment, what you're finding is even less traction than the previous one, where there was a possibility that they were leaning towards the west and overcompensating, trying to really win over the hearts and minds of the Western powers. The truth of the matter is the Western powers want one thing from Iran. They want the absolute annihilation, destruction, and termination of the Islamic Republic's establishment. They don't want the existence of this establishment, unless, of course, tomorrow Ayatollah Khamenei comes along, bends his knee, bows to the neoliberalists and the neocons and the Anglo-American Zionist Empire, does everything that Israel wants them to do, hands over the wealth of Iran, and resubjugates its people to the greater money mafias of the world. You know, unless Iran really wants to do that, unless the Iranian public wants that, unless the Iranian establishment wants that, I'm afraid what the alternative is a sort of ongoing enmity and an ongoing guarantee that the West will do its level best to try and destroy Iran.
Elijah Magnier, there were so many things that I could have started out this program with, but I chose that one. And let me see if you agree with me, because I wanted to make an analogy with how Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi talked about the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, saying that you have 2% of the world's nuclear activity taking place in Iran, but yet you have 35% of all inspections, ratio-wise, taking place on Iran's civilian nuclear program. And then you compare that with the way that Joe Biden came out when he first started his speech, where he said, we have to defend Ukraine, we got to stand up for them, which all translates into this military conflict a prolonging. Is that a correct analogy to make in the way that Iran is promoting peace through the statements that we saw, where that notion and justice was peppered or was sprayed in the Iranian president's statement as opposed to what Joe Biden was saying?
Well, indeed, it is correct. There is also more I could add to it, is in the last 43 years, Iran never declared war on any country, while the Americans declared war on Afghanistan, on Iraq, on Syria, on Lebanon, on Yemen, and supporting the Saudis in the war in Yemen. So we see that there is no similarity between what Iran is offering to the neighbors and what the Americans are offering to the world. The Americans are only talking now and very busy with their war against Russia and very preoccupied with gathering all the Western forces in country, particularly the EU, behind it, not concerned really what's happening to to its allies, because they are the ones suffering. And Iran is saying, I'm ready to abide by the JCPOA if you offer the deal and if you offer enough guarantees. While the Americans are talking from a position they are out of the JCPOA, they only offering wars, they offering weapons to Ukraine, they pushing the Europeans to offer more weapons. Nobody here in Europe has any more weapons in their warehouses. So any real war, they are in real trouble. And the Americans are producing more weapons just to send to Ukraine because it is a Western war against Russia. So they need Iran at the moment because Iran is their only hope, particularly when President Vladimir Putin announced that he is calling upon a part of reservists and he is willing to continue the war. Now, what the Europeans are going to do without the Russian oil that they are going to start imposing sanction on the 5th of December? Of course, they have Iran, they have Venezuela, and with both countries, there are sanctions imposed by the U.S. and particularly by the U.S., and nobody else dares to make business with Iran, particularly the EU, who did not, as your guest rightly said, abide by the agreement of the JCPOA and did not do any step to respect their deal and their part of the deal. So what we have today is a country that the U.S. is leading the world, but is leading the world toward more wars and more destructions. And Iran is saying, I can help you, but give me the enough insurance to return to the JCPOA, but I'm still in, but I will abide by it if you show the real intention that you are trustworthy. And
sure.
There is no point in Iran talking at the UN General Assembly because a quarter of the world there are pro-US, and the two-thirds of the world is really not against the US, but not with the US, and preferring to stay either on the side or on the side of Iran.
Right. Well, I'm wondering how those people reacted, Hossein Mohsen Abbas, and how maybe you reacted also, Hossein Mohsen Abbas, when we heard Ebrahim Raisi speaking, and he was speaking about some of the issues that we're going to hopefully get to in this program, like unilateralism and the way that the U.S. has gained political leverage through controlling institutions over other countries. And then all of a sudden, when he starts talking about martyred General Qasem Soleimani and brings up a placard of him at the podium there at the U.N. General Assembly for the world to see, that it was the U.S. that assassinated this general that was at the forefront of eradicating terrorists from the region and even beyond. What impression did you get from that? And what do you think people thought, that this was the U.S. that did it? And here you have Ebrahim Raisi raising that point.
Well, I think it's interesting that, say, that Raisi went for the humanitarian card. I mean, it's usually a weapon that often the West tries to use against Iran by inventing all sorts of bloated arguments about how despotic Iran is. I mean, of course, that's what's pumped out by most of the Western media, Western propaganda. Most Westerners haven't been to Iran for decades, if ever at all. So a lot of this propaganda can stick. But for Iran to take hold of that particular issue and to raise Haji Qasem Soleimani's placard is very significant, because what Iran is pointing to is that this region, as long as it has the American interference in the way they are prepared to interfere, you know, with their industrial military complex, with their sort of color revolutions, with their supporting of despotic, illegitimate leaders around the Gulf states, with their support of the Mossad and of Israel's Odin Yinon plan to expand across the whole of the Middle East, how on earth can you possibly have peace? The likes of Haji Qasem Soleimani, who were killed not even in action. He was killed as a diplomat traveling on the invitation of the Iraqi government, and the Americans didn't even respect that. What this shows is that the American regime has dropped so low that they actually don't really respect any international law. There is no rule of law that they really respect. So human rights violations, I mean, I think this is where Ibrahim Raisi was trying to hit, was that, look, do you really want a world where we have one bully, one unilateral bullying power that makes everybody do exactly what it wants? It was and it is okay to plunder, rape, pillage, destroy, kill, murder, maim, by their own admission. Don't forget, Mike Pompeo was very, very famously on air admitting that they steal, plunder, and do all sorts of other murderous acts, and they do it gleefully. And this is what the CIA's job is, etc. It's the job of the Mossad. It's the job of the MI6. So when you're faced with a force which knows no morality, which knows no real human rights, but touts democracy and human rights as its major reason for being in West Asia, exposing them with what they did to Qasem Soleimani is symbolic of what they've been doing against the Yemenis, against the Syrians, against the Libyans, the devastation, the ruin, the destruction they leave behind when they don't get their own way, and the theft of the gold and the oil and whatnot. Well, that's de rigueur. Whether they destroy a nation or not, they're going to steal those anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think the plea to the world, even though as my colleague rightly pointed out, the plea to the world goes almost on deaf ears, because most of these nations are puppets or fear economic sanctions from America. And again, that terrorism of an economic kind, the psychological warfare terrorism that they engage in, the manipulation behind the scenes, these are all part of a war which Iran has been at the front line of against America ever since 1979. And now, of course, the Russians and all sorts of the Chinese as well, perhaps, are going to be gradually embroiled by the absolutely psychotic behavior of the Anglo-Zionist American empire.
So what I'm curious about, Elijah Magnier, is that when you sift through and dissect what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said, and then you try to look for things there that maybe are weak at any sense of the word in terms of what he's trying to present, and this is not to just compare Iran's President's statement to the U.S. statement, it seems like Iran and Raisi, on behalf of Iran, were speaking on a position of strength, because what he was saying was, in essence, a world that should be void of all these different injustices and negativity that's being pursued and then executed by the U.S., and he named some examples. Did you get that feeling at all in terms of the way that Iran has conducted itself vis-a-vis the U.S.?
I get this impression from the first day Raisi was nominated the president. So we've seen the Americans were playing a bit cool, thinking that Iran is going to rush to ask, please return to the JCPOA negotiation. We saw how Raisi waited for 5 months before starting the negotiation. That's one. Two, the Iranian negotiator refused to have the U.S. flag in the room where the negotiation was conducted with the Europeans on behalf of the Americans, and never accepted a direct meeting or direct negotiation with the Americans. Three, we see that today when Iran is saying, I want to prove that you're going to stay in the JCPOA, and you're not going just to sign the deal, and then after that you start imposing sanctions under different reasons that are really a way for the U.S. to reimpose more sanctions. So we see Iran, had Iran wanted to sign the JCPOA, it would have been signed a month ago or even a year ago. But Iran is looking after the interest of the Iranian population by saying either we sign a good deal or no deal at all. But at the same time, Iran is sending a message to the world saying, even if I don't sign the deal and I am still in the JCPOA agreement, it doesn't mean that I'm going to go and make a bomb, although I have the knowledge to do it because I've reached 60%. I have all the advanced centrifuge of the 8th and 9th generation, and I can do it whenever I want. It's not up to you to decide if I do the bomb or not, because I will do it if I want to, but I don't want to. So this is the position of strength. At the United Nations, Raisi is talking from a position of strength, is aware what the world is going through, and saying, I am not signing the deal, although the Iranian negotiator is here in the UN, ready to negotiate, but I'm not going to sign any deal. That is a position of strength.
Sure. Well, the U.S. has always tried to alienate Iran, say Mohsen Abbas, and I believe through one of the statements that our guest there, Elijah Magnier, said before, that I recall, he said that Iran is going into this General Assembly from a position of strength, coming high off of the SCO summit that was held in Uzbekistan. And there, when you have the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi in the presence of world leaders speak and be present there, then you can't be isolated. Now, the thing is, and I'm curious about this, say Mohsen Abbas, do you think that there are many countries who would like to take this stance against, not just against the U.S., but to push back against some of the U.S. ways and methods that it has used and speak up against it like Iran has done, but they're afraid to do that because they might be subject to U.S. focus, whether it's sanctions or foreign policy?
I think you're absolutely right. I think the overwhelming majority of nations in the world are deep down sick and tired of American bullying and threats. I mean, that's how they essentially operate their empire. They threaten people through, as I mentioned, color revolutions, economic threats, through military threat. They have done this for decades, of course, and now they're masters at it. But the time is running out, because what we're seeing increasingly now is the confidence of the likes of China and Russia and Iran, three of the major economic powers, now beginning to talk about moving away from the dollar. This never happened before. They're talking about creating new means of trading with each other, away from the SWIFT banking system. There's talk of opening up that $5 billion credit line which Russia wants to offer Iran. The Chinese are not worried about sanctions when they're doing deals with Iran, Iraq, and others, going into the multi-millions around building the Belt and Road Initiative. All of this basically is saying to the Americans, look, you can't have it all your own way. A multipolar world is a much better place, rather than the kind of dictatorial unipolar world that you've been dreaming of. And I think that that's where the world is heading. The Eurasian axis, I believe, is an inevitability. The Americans are making it an inevitability by really scoring own goal after own goal. They could have a softer policy towards Iran or Russia. They could share the cake. But the trouble is they've got so greedy, and they've got had it so their own way for so long, that they really are drunk on the using military means and other means and their other cunning tactics to see if they can coerce, scare, and co-opt people into doing what they want. And all these other powers are saying, you can see China's policy. They tend to do fair deals. They don't go in and invade countries. They crack deals and they stick to those deals. They offer fair recompense in terms of building infrastructures of nations where they get resources. You could argue the wrongs and rights of that, but nonetheless, they're not imperialists in that formal sense of just raping and looting and installing leaders that they think will be conforming. So there's this rival power or a series of rival powers which are now coming up, and they will challenge America, and it will create a world that will be in flux for a considerable time yet.
Sure. Well, this world order, that's a new world order, expressed by the Iranian president, Elijah Magnier, in a few different ways. One of them was through denouncing unilateralism, in which Raisi said that American foreign policy, he said, over the past century had actually proven that the unilateralistic approach that the U.S. had actually pursued was at the self-interest and at the expense of partnerships. Do you think countries like, say, Mohsen Abbas said, don't speak up, but they really are sick and tired of it, and they perhaps are the ones that Raisi are talking about, that they feel that way?
I fully agree with Mohsen Abbas. What he said is really the truth, and this is the reality today. And we've seen that in the meeting during the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where half of the world population representative and leaders were present to talk about the exchange with their goods and trade with local currency, and they were outside the U.S. orbit. Yes, indeed, the U.S. is challenged in its unilateralism. It's still strong. We should not think that the U.S. is not going to defend itself and is not going to cause more harm and to be more harsh than it is today, because it's going to defend its throne and its position worldwide. And to do that is going to cause more damage to the world, and it is causing it, mainly to its allies in Europe and in Africa and other people who are in need of support, particularly in Afghanistan, confiscating $9 billion, etc. So, yes, the U.S. is going to defend its unilateralism, but it is challenged and is no longer going to hold for very long.
Last point that time allows us to make, say, Mohsen Abbas, I'm looking at the point that the U.S. President Joe Biden made on the use of veto power, where he said that countries should refrain from the use of this veto power. I'm wondering, when he says that, doesn't he realize then why does the U.S. use that veto power when it comes to Israel?
Well, the double standards are laughable, aren't they? This is what Aga Raisi talked about, the double standards of these Western powers. And they know it, but this, of course, they get away with murder because they can. And literally, by supporting Israel and doing what they did in terms of planting that kind of cuckoo in the nest in the Middle East, what they've done is they've perpetuated a war and a conflict which would never have been there. I mean, take Israel out of the equation there, and the odds are that you really wouldn't have the kind of turmoil and chaos and conflict. That's all created fundamentally and deliberately by the money mafias who wanted the oil and Israel to sit there as their policeman, and they continue to be hell-bent on doing that. Islamic Republic of Iran was the first to stand up genuinely in a real way. Yes, you had Jamal Abdel Nasser and all the previous wars that were kicked off. But in reality, the first constructive and really long-standing opposition to the tyranny of Zionism and Anglo-American Zionism has come from Iran. That makes it another target. And I don't think Iran is not going to let go of that. They're going to demand justice for the oppressed, and not least of all for their own people in Iran.
Thank you so much. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, a pleasure, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 for Al-Imam Sajjad in As-Sahifat As-Sajjadiyah. The Imam was seeking refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from Malakatul Hamiyah. And we said that it is Hamiyah, or zeal, is a good thing to have when it comes to a person defending his religion and his faith, and for Allah, by Allah, to Allah. But when it's done for a person's own pleasures, when it comes to him just defending his tribe and his country and his friends and people, even if they are wrong, then obviously this is what's not required. When we look at the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam, or the Quran, we see that this hamiyya is, the Quran looks down at it, and the hadith also look down at it. For example, the Quran says, إِذْ جَعَلَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ الْحَمِيَّةِ حَمِيَّةُ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ. He said, those who have denied Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, rejected Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in their hearts, they have this hamiyya, this zeal. But what kind of zeal it is? The Quran explains. He says, حَمِيَّةُ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ. Because Allah does not want to say hamiyya as a concept, or zeal as a concept, is bad. No, in fact, just the fact that when it is about jahiliyyah, when it is, you have this just pride, and this fanaticism towards your faith, towards your country, towards your tribe, towards even the jahiliyyah, for example, was towards their ignorance. But when it's done for the right purposes, it's different. Allah says, no, here you need to have the right thing. You need to have the right zeal. You need to have the right attitude towards your faith and your religion, which is obviously the true faith and religion, not any faith and religion. Let us take a short break, and then we will come back right after.
A path to salvation,